voice. "Me neither," he said. He sniffed again. "But I do smell something."
"Like what?"
"That's... oh, yes, that's psionics," he said.
"Psy what?"
"That's like mines, isn't it?" Donna asked. "How can you smell mines?" The doctor was still sniffing. "Yes, absolutely, positively psionics," he said, glancing around. "Psionic residue, lots of it. Oh, that's very interesting."
"Is it?"
"Of course, the smell's unmistakable," the doctor said. "I can't smell anything," she said.
"Yes, you can," he insisted, sniffing again. It's like hot fudge. No, candy floss."
"Candy floss?" she said dubiously. "Hang on," she added. "I do smell something. It's tapioca."
"Tapioca?" he repeated. "Not candy floss."
"Tapioca," she said.
"Maybe," he compromised, "tapioca flavoured candy floss."
"A, does it matter?" Donna asked. "And B, yuck."
"Where's it coming from?" the doctor wondered. "Where's the source?"
He prowled around her, rubbing his chin, gazing at the machinery surrounding them. "It's really powerful, really powerful. Like, no, it couldn't be."
"Couldn't be what?" Donna asked.
"Doctor?"
"Just thinking out loud," he replied.
Donna yanked him into cover. Another super had appeared, just 20 metres ahead. He looked from left to right and blinked away again.
"They're getting closer," said the doctor.
"So what?" asked Donna.
"What do you mean?" asked the doctor.
"Well, it's a hologram, isn't it?" asked Donna.
"A viral transmission, you said."
"And?"
"Exactly what can it do to us if it's not actually solid or, you know, real?" Donna asked.
"Glare at us? Use harsh language?"
"The salesman kidnapped us, remember?" the doctor said gently.
"Yeah," Donna replied, "and we're already here, so what's the worst it could do now?"
The doctor hesitated. His eyes brightened.
"Oh, that's brilliant," he exclaimed. "Donna, that's brilliant. So simple."
"Is it?" she asked.
"Oh, yes. Just perfect. What's the worst it could do?" he asked.
"I don't know," she said.
"Well, what does it do?" he prompted.
"Kidnaps people," the doctor nodded.
"It kidnaps people and whisks them away. It takes them somewhere. And now it's looking for us to do the one thing it does so well."
"Ooh," she said. She paused.
"Come again?"
He took her by the hand and led her out into the open.
"Put your shoes back on," he said. "Clomp about a bit."
"I do not clomp," she said.
"A little tap then, a little soft shoe shuffle."
The doctor looked up. "Hello," he yelled. "Hello, here we are."
"What are you doing?" Donna asked, pulling her shoes back on.
"We're right here, cooey," the doctor yelled.
Three supers appeared in front of them simultaneously. They were identical, each one haloed in a soft golden shimmer. None of them were smiling.
"Ah, there you are," cried the doctor. "Three of you, fantastic."
Gripping Donna firmly by the hand, the doctor strode right up to the nearest of the three supers and thrust his free hand deep into its holographic chest.
"Take me to your leader," the doctor said.
Like the picture on her granddad's old television set, Donna's world once again wobbled, shrank to a little white dot, and vanished into nothingness. When it blinked on again and normal service was resumed, she and the doctor found themselves standing on a broad raised platform of grilled metal running around the edge of a massive drum-shaped chamber. It felt like the inside of a missile silo. It was oppressively warm. The towering walls were slotted black metal on which red hazard lights flashed ominously. Donna turned on the spot slowly, regaining her equilibrium and taking in her surroundings. The chamber walls around the back of the platform ring were lined with complex control banks and consoles. The control banks were beaded with multicoloured lights. Holographic display screens pulsed with luminous graphic projections. Down below the platform, the centre of the chamber was dominated by an upright oblong glass tank. The tank was easily 8 metres tall. It was filled with a murky solution that looked like pond water or wallpaper paste.
"That smell," Donna said.
The doctor had already crossed to the back of the platform and was examining the control banks.
"Tapioca," he called.
"Candy floss, actually," she said.
"There's a switch," he replied.
"It's so strong," she said.
"That'll be the ilk,"
the doctor said, intently studying the consoles.
"The ilk?" she asked.
"Well, the psionic residue of the ilk, but what's the ilk?" she asked.
The doctor gestured over his shoulder at the huge glass tank.
"That's the ilk, or one of them. An ilk, I suppose I should say."
"And what's an ilk when it's at home?" she asked.
The doctor looked pensive, running his finger along a line of buttons.
"It really is at home. It's really made itself comfortable here. It's commandeered the entire control network of the edifice and reset all the automatic systems. Very clever, even for an ilk."
"Doctor?"
Donna prompted. He glanced at her.
"The ilk are a very old race of beings. Very old, odd, unpredictable, notoriously hard to communicate with."
"Why?" she asked.
"Stubborn in their old age," he suggested.
He shrugged. "They feed on emotions."
"Emotions?" she frowned.
"Raw emotions," the doctor replied. "Preferably strong emotions. The stronger the better. The ilk possess a highly developed empathic range. They consume emotions psionically and they are infamously greedy. Insatiable."
He looked over at the murky tank.
"Aren't you?"
he called. There was no response.
"Typical. Typical ilk. No pleasantries."
"Why has it brought us here?" Donna asked.
"It wants to find out who we are and what we want and why we're meddling in its business," the doctor replied. "Don't you?" he shouted at the tank.
He looked back at Donna, "which is fine by me because I want to know why it's meddling in everybody else's business. So we've got a sort of exchange of information thing going on, although I think I've already figured out what it's up to."
"Have you really?" she asked.
"Yeah," he replied, returning his attention to the complex instrument banks.
"And what will it do when it's found out why we're meddling in its business?" Donna asked.
"Whoa," the doctor replied offhandedly. "I should imagine it'll try and cook our brains with sustained bursts of pure psionic energy."
"Right, I'll look forward to that then," said Donna.
"I said try, Donna," the doctor murmured, "try being the operative word." He reached out his hand to press a button. The voice was so loud, so shudderingly deep that it hurt Donna's head. She felt dazed for a moment.
"Oh, so now you respond," the doctor cried, turning to face the tank. "Got your attention, have we?"
"Touch not,"
the voice boomed.
"Well, you say that," said the doctor, "but I actually intend to start touching quite a few of these controls."
"Will not touch."
Donna gasped and covered her ears.
"That's so loud," she cried.
"It's not making a sound," the doctor told her. "It's all psionic. Psionic communication. It's speaking in your head, aren't you?"
"Touch not,"
the voice thundered. Donna realised that the voice sounded just as loud with her hands over her ears.
"Oh, that's creepy," she said. "I can feel it. I can feel it in my head. I can taste it."
"Me too," said the doctor.
"Candy floss?"
Donna asked. The doctor nodded. He winked at her, though his face was still stern. "It's okay, Donna. It's just a big bully. A very big bully." He walked to the edge of the platform and glared down at the huge tank.
"You've put on a lot of weight, haven't you, Ilk? Since you got here, you've done nothing but feed. You feasted, in fact. Gorged yourself. You couldn't stop, could you? It was just so yummy. You just ate and ate and kept on stuffing yourself. You've got so big, you need that support tank just to ease your bulk."
There was no answer. The doctor sighed.
"If you can't take an honest, well-meant criticism from a friend," he began.
Something moved in the murky fluid of the tank. A great pallid shape rolled through the gloop and pressed part of itself against the glass. Donna couldn't see all of the creature, just a patch of puffy white flesh. It was squashing against the tank wall like a child, pressing its face against a window. She heard the wet flesh oink and squeal against the glass surface.
"Well, that's gross," she said.
A large, bloodshot eye the size of a football opened in the patch of white flesh and stared out at her. It was filmed white as if suffering from cataracts. Two smaller, mismatched eyes blinked open in the flesh beneath them. "Oh, my God!" Donna said, recoiling and clapping her hands to her mouth. She took several quick steps backwards. The doctor waved down at the staring eyes. "Someone needs to take you in hand, Ilk," he said. "You're ruining your health with all that overeating. You need to trim down and lose a few yards. I know a very good personal trainer."
"Feed,"
the voice rumbled. "I think you've had quite enough for now," the doctor replied. He walked back over to the control panels. "This is for your own good. You brought it on yourself. I'm going to have to cut you off."
"Touch not."
"Don't plead," said the doctor. "It's undignified." Very deliberately, he started to press buttons and alter the control panel settings.
"Touch not."
The voice boomed, louder than ever before. The doctor continued to throw switches and turn dials heedlessly. There was a sudden, overpowering stench of candy floss. The doctor yelled in pain and fell down on one knee, grimacing, his hands pressed to his temples.
"Touch not!"
"Doctor!" Donna cried, running to him. I'm all right," the doctor said, getting up again. A little psionic warning shot across the bows. "Nothing I can't handle." He pressed three more buttons and turned a switch.
"Not!"
the voice howled. The gagging reek of candy floss billowed again. With a strangled cry, the doctor fell against the control panels, his eyes clamped shut and his mouth wide open in pain. "Stop it! Stop it!" Donna screamed at the tank. She looked at the doctor. "What can I do? Doctor, how can I help? Tell me!" "Don't do anything!" the doctor hissed through gritted teeth. "It hasn't targeted you yet, just me. It's just trying to get me to stop." "So stop before it kills you," she cried. "I can't, Donna," the doctor said, hauling himself up. "I can't let it do this. All those people, all those lives, I can't let it. I need to reverse these settings." And he yelped again, his hands to his head. This time the Ilk hadn't even let him touch the controls. Oh, the doctor groaned. "It's strong. It's very strong, but I don't think it's strong enough." With shaking, clumsy fingers, he began making desperate adjustments to the control banks again.
"Not!"
the voice demanded. The doctor convulsed in pain so violently that Donna thought he was about to keel over. Instead, he leaned on the control panel heavily, breathing hard. "That the best you've got?" he said with effort. "That support tank you're in, it's limited your psionic range, hasn't it? It's blunted your sting, which is bad news for you because you have no idea who you're dealing with." The murky fluid in the huge tank bubbled and swirled suddenly.
"Time Lord,"
the voice rumbled.
"Yes, that's right," gasped the doctor. "You've finally figured it out. Well done, Ilk."
He started pressing buttons again. A series of heavy, thumping clanks issued from the tank. Frothing and gurgling, the fluid inside began to drain out through the vents in the tank space and pour away through the grilled drains in the chamber floor. The water level in the tank began to drop sharply. Something massive, pale and contorted, was slowly emerging from the receding water. "What's it doing?" Donna asked.
"It's coming out to play," said the doctor.
"The tank's inhibiting its psionics, so it's getting out of the bath to take a direct shot at me." "Won't that kill you?" she asked. "There's a possibility," the doctor agreed. His hands were moving rapidly over the control systems. New sequences and patterns of lights flashed up. "If I can just reload these settings before it gets clear." Donna shot a worried glance at the draining tank. She could see more of the grotesque thing inside the glass box than she really wanted to.
"You said it was feeding," she said. "What do you mean it was feeding?"
"Doctor, it was feeding on the edifice, on the people."
"Oh yes," he replied. "I believe the edifice was a legitimate luxury development originally. Then the Ilk found it and took control deep down here in the heart. It reset the viral transmission systems, making them far more aggressive and indiscriminate. It reset the salesmen to snatch people, Donna, to kidnap all the living beings they could find, as many as possible.
And bring them here?"
Donna began in horror.
"Yes, to keep its vast and personal larder freshly stocked with snacks."
"Oh my God," Donna said.
The edifice, said the doctor, is its meal ticket. It's feeding on a rich and varied diet of powerful emotions generated by the building's huge and turbulent population.
Oh, my God! Donna cried, louder and more profoundly than before. It wants all the pain and horror, all the despair, all the panic, all the killing. It's done this deliberately.
The strongest emotions are the most delicious, said the doctor.
That's outrageous, Donna exclaimed. That's obscene.
She wheeled around and marched towards the edge of the platform. Down below, the tank finished emptying, and the glass walls slowly withdrew into recesses in the floor. The ilk was revealed. It was a massive, dripping, misshapen blob of wrinkled white blubber, a bloated monster the size of a bull elephant. It had no solid anatomical structure. Glistening pseudopod limbs pulsed and flailed out of its puckered flesh as the rolls of its morbidly obese mass spilled out like wet dough over the tank's base. Scores of glazed, staring eyes, some as large as beach balls, some the size of coconuts, some tiny and clustered together like frog spawn or winking cappuccino foam, blinked open across its bulk. Faced by such a thing, Donna Noble should have balked a little, but her blood was up.
How dare you! She yelled at it. It writhed towards her, reaching up with oozing pseudopod limbs. How dare you do this? Who do you think you are? Have you no shame? Have you no pity? People have died just so you could get lunch. Exactly where do you get off?
Feed! The ilk roared in her head. Donna wasn't going to be put off. There was a fire in her belly. She was going to have her say.
All of this, right? You've packed this whole flipping place to the rafters with people just so you could get your jollies. You disgust me. Have you fed on me, too? Have you? My emotions? When I was afraid of falling, did you like that? Was it tasty? When I thought the doctor was dead, was that scrummy for you? When I thought those nano things were going to eat me, was that delicious, was it? Oi, I'm talking to you.
The pseudopod limbs recoiled slightly. They writhed uncertainly. The ilk made a loud grumbling sound.
I'll tell you this much, Donna declared, stabbing an angry finger at the ilk. I am appalled. I am simply flipping appalled. How does anyone, anything, play with lives like that? Just to scoff yourself. You should be ashamed. They were my emotions. They were mine.
The ilk rumbled again. It was an uncomfortable, intestinal sound.
Donna!
The doctor yelled, feverishly making some last adjustments to the control settings.
Don't make it target you. Don't anger it. Anger it? She roared. Anger it? It should worry. Donna, please, the doctor cried.
Touch not.
The voice in their heads boomed. The rancid smell of candy floss flooded the chamber. The doctor wailed in pain and fell against the control panels, twitching and shaking, his hands dropping uselessly from the dials.
Leave him alone, Donna yelled. You hear me? How dare you? Leave him alone.
Now the ilk really recoiled, rolling its huge mass back away from the platform. Its myriad eyes seemed to water. Its flexing pseudopods quivered like sea anemone limbs in an undertow.
Donna, the doctor croaked. Donna, that's good. That's great, in fact.
He forced himself upright.
Well done. We've nearly got it.
Have we? Donna asked, turning. The doctor looked at her. His face was drawn and pale, but he was grinning.
Just about, he said. Just you keep it in its place for a moment longer.
Donna looked back at the ilk. It was making the most unpleasant gastric noises.
Ashamed of ourselves, are we? She asked.
The ilk surged at her. With shocking, almost incomprehensible speed, the ilk pushed its pallid bulk forwards. It crashed against the stanchions supporting the platform, and the whole structure shuddered. Donna cried out in alarm and stumbled backwards. Glistening, dribbling pseudopods snaked in through the platform railings to grab at her. Other, smaller pseudopods pushed up between the grills of the platform decking beneath her. The ilk had rolled part of its bulk under the platform and was sprouting fat tendrils of white flesh up through the slits. Some of them caught Donna's feet as she backed away and she fell.
Doctor! She screamed as the sucking tendrils flapped and groped for her. She scrambled backwards on her bottom, kicking away the reaching pseudopods as they slapped at her. One of them grabbed her left shoe and tore it off.
Doctor!
She yelped.
Almost there! He yelled. Not the right answer!
She bellowed. The white tendrils squeezing up between the platform slats were all over her, clammy and grasping. The ilk had her in its grasp. A hand took hers and pulled her free. It pulled her out of the ilk's squirming clutches and dragged her to her feet.
Doctor, she said.
Holding her hand tight, he smiled at her.
Shouldn't you be over there pressing something important?
She asked. I've pressed it, he said. They turned to look at the ilk. Light flashed and fluttered like the afterimage of a violent storm. The writhing mass of the ilk wobbled and its multiple eyes winked furiously as if in dismay. Then it shrank to a little white dot, and the little white dot vanished into nothingness. It was suddenly very cold and damp in the empty chamber. What did you do? Donna whispered. I reset the edifice's sentient spam system, the doctor replied softly. I caught the ilk in its own scam. I sent it away. Where to? She asked. Somewhere lonely and far away, the doctor said. Somewhere where it will have to go on a long, strict diet. He beamed at her.
What did you do, though?
She shrugged. Shouted a lot, lost a shoe. I don't know. What? She asked.
Well, said the doctor, I think you gave it indigestion.
Indigestion? Donna said. It should have killed me once it was free of the tank, the doctor said, but it didn't have the strength. The ilk was indisposed, uncomfortable. She narrowed her eyes. I gave it indigestion, she asked.
Yes, you did, Donna Noble, the doctor grinned. You gave it what for and the ilk didn't like it.
It eats emotions and you choked it with an emotion that it found indigestible. Not pain, not terror, not rage, just simple disgust and disapproval.
Did I?
Donna asked. The doctor nodded.
You gave it indigestion, he said, and it was so racked with discomfort it couldn't summon enough psionic energy to finish me off.
Oh, right, she said, which bought me enough time to reset the controls.
And you're saying I did all that? Donna asked.
You, and only you, replied the doctor. She breathed deeply. What about my shoe? She asked. I lost my shoe. The doctor's fingers were flicking over the console so fast that Donna could barely follow them.
There, done, the doctor announced.
He pushed a red key that lit up and flashed.
Done? Asked Donna. What have you done? I've cancelled all lifehold agreements and reversed the entire viral transmission system, he said. I've sent everyone back to where they came from.
Everyone? Donna asked. The doctor shrugged. I can't bring back the dead ones. Mr. and Mrs. Krill and their son Philip, for instance. They'll be just as dead when they get home as they were when they were here.
Donna pouted.
We pick up the pieces, Donna, the doctor said sadly, but sometimes the pieces are broken.
I suppose, she replied.
Some residents will stay, the doctor said.
Will they? She asked.
He made a happy shrug. The system won't send back anybody who actively chooses to be here. The edifice is a development, after all, a legitimate undertaking.
Who'd want to live here? After this? Donna asked.
You'd be surprised, the doctor replied. The edifice systems will self-repair any damage and the food replicators will come back online to cater for any guests.
Can we leave? Donna asked. Is it all right for us to leave?
The doctor nodded emphatically. No problem there. I've switched off the signals that were damping the TARDIS's dematerialization circuit.
Which is extremely clever, Donna replied. But how do we get back to the TARDIS?
Well, said the doctor.
Oh, give it here, Donna tutted.
He tossed the sonic screwdriver over to her. She caught it neatly and pressed the head of it into a slot on the silo wall.
Like this? Donna asked.
You're doing fine, the doctor replied.
There was a whirring noise. It grew louder.
Then there was a single and very precise ping. The elevator doors rolled open and issued a warm glow and the sound of Coca Cabana in Muzak form.
Floor?
Asked Frank. The lift hummed as it ascended. The light on the indicator board crept around the complex pattern of bulbs. The Muzak played, "The Only Way Is Up."
"You said 160, didn't you?" Frank asked.
"Yup," Donna nodded. 160 all the way. Lucky 160.
"You're going to stay here then?" the doctor asked.
The lift attendant shrugged.
"It's a paying job, sir."
"But the edifice is empty now," Donna said.
"Oh, it'll fill up again soon enough, madam," Frank told her. "Place like this, they'll be queuing up for it. Round the block they'll be."
"If you say so," said Donna. The lift slewed to a halt and the doors made a ping.
"Level 160, Frank announced.
The elevator doors rolled open.
"Thanks,"
said Donna to Frank as she stepped out.
"No tip?"
the lift attendant queried. The doctor shook him seriously by the hand. "Get another job. Failing that, enjoy this one and be as considerate to your other passengers as you were to us. That's my tip."
"Oh, right, sir," said Frank.
He waved a little confused wave as the doors closed.
"Mind how you go."
Donna and the doctor strolled down the hallway of level 160 to their apartment door.
"Do I get to drive this time?" Donna asked.
"No, you don't," the doctor replied. They walked into the apartment, side by side, into the bedroom, into the plywood wardrobe, and into the TARDIS. Edie came out of her apartment and knocked on the door of 16064. Her antennae wibbled. She was clutching another freshly baked cake. There was no answer, but from inside, Edie could hear something wheezing, moaning, juddering, and vibrating. Cycling through time and space, the TARDIS rotated away from the edifice and left it far behind. The edifice turned slowly in the hazy mauve light of its neighbouring star. Self-repair systems began purring quietly. A giant sign perched on a rocky asteroid drifting near the edifice began to light up, flashing and crackling with waking neon. When the sign was fully illuminated, it read,
"Exclusive lifestyle investment opportunity. Luxury apartments available."
Doctor Who, The Forever Trap by Dan Abnett, was read by Catherine Tate. It was produced by Kate Thomas and is published by BBC Audiobooks. Bertram Ramsay jolted awake with a gasp, his chest heaving, his eyes snapping about wildly. He dreamt about death. Not his, but the deaths of hundreds, thousands of young men he had sent into battle at sea. Each dragged screaming into the boiling ocean, pulled down by the grasping hands of skeletons that had burst from beneath the waves. All of his men were taken, one by one by one.
"Everything all right, sir?"
The voice of his chauffeur broke his reverie. Ramsay nodded. He opened the car window, drawing in lungfuls of cold night air as he slowly focused on reality. Settling back in the seat, he gently patted his leather briefcase, partly for reassurance, but mainly to check it was still there. And then he turned again to look out of the window as his car drove on through the night. A rapidly thickening swathe of fog rolled in off the English Channel, and the stone towers of Dover Castle,
perched vertiginously on the white cliffs above the harbour, were gradually obscured. Lower down the cliff face, huddled in the scrubby vegetation, was an innocuous red brick arch, beyond which a passageway led to a set of heavy metal doors. Behind these doors lay the secret war tunnels, a military command centre built into catacombs hewn deep into the chalk cliffs. From these tunnels, the British naval war effort was being controlled. Two ratings flanked the entrance. Able seaman Fosbrook, early 30s, quirkily good-looking, with dark hair and deep-set, earnest eyes, and ordinary seaman Mansell, younger and with an air of vulnerability that set him apart from the rest of the men. There was a scuff of booted feet from within the tunnels, and the two ratings came to attention and saluted, rapid, effortless, and sharp. Commodore William Jarman, an imposing man of 47 years, immaculate in full dress uniform, strode out, nodded to the ratings, and returned their salute. His eyes flicked towards the heavily guarded main gates. In the distance, a pair of yellowish headlights glowed through the sulphurous fog. He straightened his tie as the black Rolls-Royce powered into the courtyard, and Fosbrook stepped promptly forward and opened the rear door. A small, slight man emerged. He wore a trench coat and a peaked cap and carried a briefcase. Commodore Jarman saluted briskly. "Good to have you back, Vice Admiral," he said, his voice clipped. "Good journey from London?"
"Can we get on with this, Bill?" Ramsay scowled at Jarman and strode past him.
As the two men melted away into the depths of the tunnels, Fosbrook closed the car door. As he did so, he glanced up. His mouth opened wide in shock. Above the swirling fog, the night sky was ripping itself open, spilling brilliant scarlet light across the channel. If Fosbrook had only understood what it was, he might have felt privileged. He was looking into the time vortex itself. As matter swirled violently round the ripping time, he could see deep into its throat. As he squinted, staring at the awesome sight before him, he could see two distant objects deep within the maw of the swirling time tunnel. Two objects racing towards the breach in time and space. Racing towards him. Something was coming to 1940. Doctor Who, The Nemanite Invasion, by David Roden, read by Catherine Tate. Deep within the time vortex, the TARDIS spun through the iridescent shimmer buffeted by the time winds. Inside was chaos. There were alarms, and smoke filled the air. The Doctor was wild and wired, darting back and forth around the console. He was sliding levers with his left hand, twisting dials with his right. A stream of sparks cascaded from the top of the glass central column and rained down on the Doctor and Donna.
"What's going on?"
she yelled. The Doctor's hands flashed across buttons.
"We've hit some sort of instability in the vortex. It must be the wake from that ship we're following. But we'll be through it any moment."
The Doctor's voice rose in anticipation.
"Now!"
The whole machine careered suddenly to the left.
"We haven't lost it, have we?"
Donna exclaimed above the raucous din.
"Don't tell me we've actually lost it."
The Doctor briefly flicked a glance in her direction.
"The TARDIS has smashed out of the vortex. It's free-falling into real space."
Donna hauled herself around the console towards him.
"You said this would work." "No, I didn't. I said travelling at this speed through the vortex might tear the TARDIS apart and we might both die horribly." "Oi!" she shouted. "This isn't funny anymore. My stomach's in my mouth."
The Doctor beamed at her.
"Oh, Donna Noble, you old cynic, you. This is the best bit. You should embrace the experience."
And then, with a dull crump and a stinking cloud of plasticky smoke, all the lights went out. Deep in the bowels of the war tunnels, Commodore Jarman held open the door to the operations room and stood aside as Ramsay stepped into the low-ceilinged, gloomy heart of the British naval war effort.
The room was grey and slightly shabby, with a large circular plotting table at its centre, a map of the English Channel sprawled across it. Communications equipment lined the walls, manned by operators with headphones. Ramsay paused in the doorway and turned discreetly to Jarman.
I was sorry to hear about your son.
Thank you, sir, said Jarman softly. It's been trying of late, first my wife, then my boy. But I'm here and I'm working.
Ramsay squeezed Jarman's shoulder gently.
How was the meeting, sir? Jarman inquired, changing the subject hurriedly.
My doctor says I'm a walking stroke, Ramsay announced. Can you believe that? My blood pressure's 190 over 140, bloody quack. What does he know?
Jarman gave a tiny smile. I meant the meeting with the Prime Minister, sir.
Ramsay's eyes narrowed slightly. I know. He smiled at the rest of the room.
Right, gentlemen, put your brains in gear. We're going to rout the enemy.
He laid his briefcase down on the plotting table and cleared his throat.
We have before us our greatest challenge. I have come straight from a meeting with our Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill. As you know, the British Expeditionary Force has withdrawn to Dunkirk, close to 500,000 men. German tank divisions are advancing on them and their backs are to the sea. We have 6 days to evacuate our troops from the beaches before they are slaughtered. The plan is codenamed Operation Dynamo. We'll divide the briefing into... The door slammed open and Fosbrook burst in.
Sir, outside, you've got to see this! Fosbrook barely had the breath to talk.
Ramsay looked up.
For God's sake, man, pull yourself together, name and rank.
Fosbrook saluted immediately. His eyes widened and he gulped nervously.
Abel Seaman Fosbrook, PSSX 771698, sir!
Jarman stepped forward and hissed.
Fosbrook, what the hell are you playing at?
In the sky, sir, said Fosbrook. I think it's some new German weapon.
On the small balcony that formed the end of the tunnel where it emerged from the cliffs, Jarman leant on the railings, his eyes scanning the channel. Ramsay stood at his shoulder, scowling. There was an odd tang in the air, he thought, not unlike hot ozone.
Nothing, said Jarman. You useless article.
Fosbrook's brow was beaded with a fine sheen of sweat.
Sorry, sir. There was something.
Ramsay clapped Fosbrook firmly on the shoulder and grinned.
I think the pressure's getting to the men, Commodore. Crack!
There was a colossal detonation high in the night sky. A wave of energy swept the men backwards, lifting them off their feet and brutally slamming them into the cliff. The glass windows behind them exploded noisily. Jarman leapt up, grabbing Ramsay and hauling him to his feet.
Inside, sir, he urged.
Ramsay shook him off.
Is that your blasted Nazi weapon? He said, pointing upwards.
The sky was stained crimson as it was ripped open again. Within a second, an incandescent crystalline sphere was exploding out of the gash, flaring like magnesium, and screamed down through the fog, trailing boiling smoke.
Call the gatehouse! Go to alert state red! Shouted Jarman, and Fosbrook fled back inside the tunnels.
Inside the TARDIS, thick smoke billowed through the metal grills by the time traveller's feet. The doctor raced around to the scanner, angling the display so he could see it better.
It can't be. No. Why does it have to be 1940?
1940? Said Donna. But that's good, isn't it?
The controls have seized up, he told her. Hold tight, we're going down.
He beamed broadly, loving the adrenaline. Suddenly, the whole room tilted at a crazy angle and Donna saw the doctor's expression transform to one of horror. She turned her head to follow his gaze. The doors were swinging slowly open as the TARDIS screamed down towards the surface of the sea. A howling gale roared around the TARDIS console room. Donna embraced the doctor, holding him tightly.
I think I may have misjudged, slightly, the doctor shouted in her ear.
She looked towards the doors, the sea below drawing rapidly closer.
Oh my God, we're going to drown!
And she closed her eyes and turned her head away, burying it in the doctor's side. Her heart pounded and the roar of blood hammered in her ears as she waited for the inevitable impact. As he watched the pyrotechnics above, Ramsay's eyes glittered with fascination. With a deafening boom, the sphere impacted on the surface of the English Channel. A huge steaming cloud of vapour mushroomed up into the night sky and then was swallowed up by the fog. And now, what appeared to be a tiny blue box streaked towards the surface of the sea. Ramsay furrowed his brow. What in heaven's name was happening tonight? This was certainly no German weapon.
Ramsay caught one final glimpse of the blue box as it spun out of control towards the sea, and then it too was swallowed up by the impenetrable wall of fog.
"Something's crash-landed out there," he said to Jarman. "You might want to investigate."
He shivered. He was a logical man. He liked order and organisation, not chaos and anarchy. The rule of law and procedures to follow were security for him. This was something he didn't understand, and that troubled him.
Spitting out a mouthful of seawater, the doctor bobbed like a cork on the swell. Somewhere a bell clanged, softened into a song by the distance. He wondered vaguely whether it might be a far-off church. No, probably a marker boy out at sea. "Donna!" he shouted. No response.
There was a low rumbling noise, and the surface of the water erupted in a foaming tumult as the familiar shape of the TARDIS pitched to the surface and settled on its side, rising and dipping on the waves. The doctor swam over and grabbed the metal door handle.
"Donna!" he shouted again, panic rising inside him.
Donna was surging upwards, her feet surrounded by bubbles as she thrashed in panic. Her lungs were burning. "I am not going to die," she thought. "I can't die." Then her face broke the surface, and with relief she gulped in the cold night air. As she grasped the wooden frame of the police box, she felt a hand take her arm.
"How cold is this water?" she shivered. "Blimey," said the doctor. "Thought I'd lost you. You all right?"
"My underwear is waterlogged, I'm freezing cold, and I've had a mouthful of Chateau de Channel. So, on reflection, Joe 90, no, I'm not all right."
She brushed her sopping wet hair back off her face.
"There we are then,"
the doctor smiled.
"Brilliant." "What's brilliant about that?"
Donna raised her eyebrows.
"Bruised, battered, but buoyant," he said cheerfully.
Donna's breath condensed in the night air around her.
"What about that thing?" she ventured. "What happened to it?"
The doctor stared intently at the rolling expanse of black ocean around them.
"I messed up, Donna," he said grimly. "I lost it."
A finger of pale yellow light cut through the fog, washing over the edge of the TARDIS. Somewhere nearby, they could hear the chug of a motor. With an asthmatic toot from a horn, the prow of a small naval inshore patrol boat suddenly loomed out of the fog. The doctor laughed.
"Cheer up! You're about to be saved by the Royal Navy!"
"Well, I hope they've got something for seasickness," she said.
Submerged in the mud on the seabed beneath them, the sphere pulsed with a soft blue light. The glow began to fade until the light died completely. And then, torrents of fizzing, seething bubbles exploded from its shell. An enormous crack ripped across its surface, and a clawed hand burst from inside the alien craft. Ramsay impatiently clicked his fingers at a young rating.
"Get a move on, I haven't got all day."
"Sir," the rating saluted. Ramsay took the proffered case and stood for a moment, his fingers trembling and his heart pounding. Over the years, he'd seen countless men killed in the course of duty, and sometimes because of decisions he had made. No one knew how heavily that weighed on him. He'd resigned from the Navy in 1938, partly to assuage the crushing feelings of guilt, but the government had insisted he return a year later to help with a war effort. He took out his briefing notes and laid them on the table. He was a cautious man. He had to be sure this rescue plan was the right thing to do. He sipped at a piping hot mug of naffy tea and stared at the manila folder. How the hell could he justify risking civilian lives? The Commodore discreetly cleared his throat.
"We've picked up two survivors, sir. We're bringing them in now."
The patrol boat cut its way through the drifting banks of fog. In the stern stood the TARDIS, and in the bow, the doctor and Donna huddled in rough grey woolen blankets. Two ratings stood nearby, watching them with suspicious eyes.
"Is that your teeth chattering?"
the doctor nudged Donna.
"Don't even talk to me," she retorted.
He began idly fiddling with the sonic screwdriver. Donna leaned in towards him.
"It's 1940. I'm in 1940. So where are we?"
The doctor seemed not to have heard her question. She jabbed him in the ribs and shook her head.
"So childish."
The doctor looked up.
"Hmm? What? Me? Oh, right.
He pointed towards a distant shadowy silhouette on the rapidly approaching clifftop.
White cliffs, blue birds, Dover Castle, he grinned. Rescued by the Navy. What a laugh, eh?
Donna smiled back.
So, are we under arrest then, or whatever it is the Navy do? Oh, they'll be inquisitive. We've made quite an entrance.
He suddenly smacked his forehead with the palm of his hand.
Your pain threshold, is it quite, you know, high?
Donna's face blanched.
You what?
She asked incredulously.
Are you serious?
Just curious, he told her, examining the screwdriver.
They're gonna torture us, she stammered, outraged.
The doctor wrinkled his nose.
Royal Navy? Nah, never in a million years. Well, probably not. Well, hopefully not.
She caught the briefest flicker of a smirk.
That's a space joke. That's how you great big Dumbo aliens get your kicks, is it?
A big smile crept across her face.
I will so get you back for that.
Deep beneath them, something was moving. Something was travelling at high speed through the water. And in the crushing darkness, the creature heard a symphony of underwater sounds, the rare and secret noises that undersea species share. And then it detected something in the water ahead. Something large. Something metal. Sensing food, or perhaps safety, it surged towards the iron-grey bulk suspended in the murky depths ahead. Ramsay sipped his brew and stared miserably at the folder in front of him, only dimly aware that Jarman was calling his name.
Sir, we're ready.
Snapping back to reality, he put down his mug and rose creakily from his chair. Forcing a broad smile, he opened the manila folder, and the briefing on Operation Dynamo officially began.
We shall send over a flotilla of small craft, fishing boats, ferries, pleasure craft, yachts, anything that floats. We use these as lighters to ferry the troops out to our warships standing off the beach.
Ramsay pushed his fingers through his hair and sighed deeply.
No, he said at last. Vice Admiral? Jarman said.
Everyone looked up at their commanding officer.
No, I can't allow it, Ramsay said finally.
What?
Jarman said, suddenly concerned. It's my fault. Blame me. It's ludicrous, suggesting we use civilians to crew these craft, Ramsay told him.
Jarman spoke urgently. We have 6 days before the Nazis arrive.
Can you imagine what it would do to our country's morale if thousands of civilians were killed during one of our own military operations? Ramsay forged on. We simply don't have the time, sir. There are 42 warships already standing by. It's our best option. It's our only option.
Ramsay thought for a moment, the conflict tearing him apart.
We've lost too many good people already. I will not have unnecessary deaths on my conscience.
He angrily tossed the manila folder towards Jarman. There was an unpleasant silence.
Sir, you're knowingly defying a direct order from London,
Jarman said in a hushed voice.
Ramsay nodded slowly, his eyes showing exactly how aware he was of what he was doing.
I'm sorry, Bill. We are going to teach those Nazi bully boys a lesson they will never forget, but I will not risk untrained civilians doing it. If we do, expect hard and heavy tidings. We must find another way.
In the darkness, there were gunshots and wretched screams of agony. German sailors were fleeing for their lives, desperately scrambling for safety. Something had got inside their U-boat and was slaughtering them. The creature burst from the shadows, striking them down, savage, silent, and brutal. A hand reached towards the radio set, trembling fingers plucking a microphone from its stand. A young German sailor crawled underneath a desk, shivering.
Mayday! Mayday! We need help!
Said Engel, clutching the microphone close to his mouth. A sudden noise nearby alerted him. He didn't even have time to scream before the creature was upon him. Ramsay lowered himself down onto one of the rough wooden benches in the chapel and began to pray. As he sat in the chill darkness, he tried hard to concentrate, but the insistent tapping noise behind him was becoming intolerable. Finally, he turned to remonstrate, then his face suddenly melted into a broad grin.
"Clayton, you filthy, backstabbing blackguard," he roared. "You don't know how delighted I am to see a friendly face."
Chaplain Clayton, in his early 60s, with a shock of greying hair, dark glasses and a white cane, crossed towards him. Ramsay grasped his hand, shaking it hard. Clayton reached his hand up to Ramsay's face and felt delicately across the contours. "You're putting on weight, Bertie." Ramsay laughed and sat down again. Clayton joined him and after a moment said gently, "Are you all right?" Ramsay said, "I thought doing my duty was simple." Clayton folded his arms. "Doing your duty is simple. Living with yourself afterwards, now, that's the hard bit." "I'm sick of turning over the bodies of men I admire," said Ramsay. "If you're looking for spiritual help to make your decisions, then I'm the wrong man to talk to," Clayton said. "Your men, they're the ones you should be talking to. What would you give up for them, Ramsay? What are you prepared to lose?" And for once, Ramsay had no answer. As Donna and the doctor stepped onto the harbour wall, Fosbrook was waiting, a small torch in his hand. Donna smiled winningly. "Hello, sailor." The doctor tried to mask a smile. "I can't take you anywhere." "Would you follow me, please?" Fosbrook turned and led the way along the quayside. "Just a few questions, ma'am." Donna laughed. "Ma'am? Oh, check you out. You actually call people ma'am?" There was a moment of silence and then she asked, "So what's your name, sailor boy?" Fosbrook turned to look at her and Donna caught a glimpse of his deep-set brown eyes. She smiled at him, not really expecting a response. But much to her surprise, he gave her a big, cheeky grin. "Abel Seaman Fosbrook, ma'am." "Abel?" she said, a glint in her eye. There was a groan at her side and the doctor cast his eyes heavenwards. "What?" she asked. "Oh, can you just put him down?" the doctor said. "I'm motivating the troops," she said. "We haven't got time for this," the doctor hissed in her ear. "We need to find that creature. Now listen, we get in, say our hellos and thank yous, blah, 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 and we get out. You understand?" Huge metal doors slammed behind them and Fosbrook led them deep into the cliffside. Donna began to feel more and more claustrophobic as the ceilings became lower and the air heavier and more oppressive. After some minutes, the doctor lost patience. "Have you got a shop?" he beamed. "I bet you've got a little shop. Go on, tell me you have. I bet you sell Dover Rock or those little shaky snow globe thingies. This way, is it?" With that, he stalked off at right angles. "Sir, please, you can't just..." Fosbrook began. Donna interrupted him. "I wouldn't argue, mate. You're wasting your breath, trust me." Cursing, Fosbrook began to follow the doctor. Ahead, the doctor grasped a door handle, turned and fixed Fosbrook with a wide grin. "Now, if I'm not mistaken, and I never am, well, very rarely, well, hardly, anyway, through here, far more interesting." And with that, he flung the door open and went inside. Everyone in the operations room stopped what they were doing and turned to look at the bedraggled stranger. The doctor thrust both hands deep into his trouser pockets and leant forward, his mouth wide open with joy and delight.
"Oh, brilliant," he laughed. "Vice Admiral Bertram Home Ramsay, you were the last person I expected to see. Oh, how to brighten up a bad day."
As Donna and Fosbrook joined the doctor, Commodore Jarman exploded.
"This is a secure area," Fosbrook saluted. "These are the survivors we fish from the sea, sir."
The doctor nudged Donna. "Donna, look, it's..." But Donna didn't want telling. "Some short bloke in a uniform, whatever. I'd be impressed if you had Winston Churchill in a cupboard. That would be worth getting excited about." Ignoring her, the doctor raced forwards, brushing wet hair out of his eyes and proffering his right hand. "I've always wanted to meet you. I've always said I bet you're brilliant." Ramsay ignored the doctor's outstretched hand. "I hope I can live up to your expectations." Donna nudged the doctor. "I don't mind the magical mystery history tour," she whispered quietly, "but who the hell is he?" The doctor smiled.
"Oh, Donna, I need to have a word with your history teacher. This man is an unsung naval genius. Do you know how many men's lives he saved?"
Ramsay was smiling at Donna. "You have the look of my darling wife, Helen. Intriguing. May I even say delightful? And you are..."
"My assistant," the doctor whipped the psychic paper from inside his jacket.
Scientific advisor, special covert forces, Ministry of Defence. See the photo, not my best side.
Ramsay regarded him with uncertain eyes.
Your name, sir?
Oh, just doctor will do.
Just doctor?
I like to travel under the radar.
Then it's just Vice Admiral to you. This is Commodore Jarman.
Jarman stepped forward and snatched the psychic paper from the doctor's hand.
Dr. John Smith, civilian personnel, he muttered.
Let joy be unconfined. He tossed the psychic paper back to the doctor.
Ramsay turned back to Donna.
And you, dear lady, your name?
Donna Noble, she replied.
Ramsay pondered for a moment.
Just Doctor and Donna Noble, he contemplated. What were you doing in the sea?
Did your plane crash?
The doctor answered quickly.
No. Well, yes. Well, kind of. I've got a sort of ship thing and yes, it crashed. Sort of.
Ramsay raised a quizzical eyebrow.
So, can you enlighten me as to what you were doing here?
The doctor waved his hand dismissively.
Oh, you know, just looking for anything odd, out of the ordinary, anything that makes you go, ooh, that's funny.
Donna interrupted. We're part of a new team, investigating unusual and unexplained phenomena.
Like that shooting star?
Ramsay prompted. Forgive me, I haven't heard of this new team. Its name?
Donna rolled her shoulders back and brushed her hair from her face, thinking fast.
She flicked a nervous glance at the doctor. We're working for the X-Files.
The doctor shook his head in disbelief.
What? She hissed.
Ramsay was perplexed.
So this shooting star, the doctor cut in. We may need your help to deal with it. Please, we could be in the most appalling danger.
Ramsay laughed.
Danger? We have the Luftwaffe in our skies and U-boats in our oceans.
The doctor interrupted again, his voice urgent. Mr. Ramsay, out there in the channel is...
I heard you, Ramsay told him. Your insistence is...
Noted? The doctor smiled cheerily.
Tedious, Ramsay replied.
He tapped the doctor on the lapel. You'd better find it then, before it does any harm.
And put some dry clothes on, man. You're making a mess on the damn floor.
Jarman approached, looking worried.
Sir, we've received a mayday, near where the star fell. It's German. We think it's a U-boat. My recommendation, sir?
Ramsay nodded.
Jarman smiled a tiny, hard smile before speaking. We blast it out of the water. Kill everyone on board. Now hang on, Commodore, the doctor bristled. We need to investigate, find out what prompted the mayday. Who the hell do you think you are? Jarman snarled.
Donna stepped forwards protectively.
Oi, you can back off, Captain Pugwash. All right. It's Commodore Jarman to you, he said icily.
I can think of something else I'd like to call you, Donna snapped back. I can put Commodore in front of that if you like.
Vice Admiral, we need to look inside that U-boat, the doctor said.
I'm not sure what to do, Ramsay looked confused. But I think the doctor may have a point, Commodore.
Jarman rounded on Ramsay with surprising venom. We're at war. We're protecting this country. I'll still be here, sir, long after you've been retired. Again.
What is it? Don't you have the spine to fight the battle? Too old to remember what the rush of adrenaline was like?
Of course you're not sure what to do.
How dare you bark at me, Ramsay said. Remember your place.
There was a pause. When he spoke again, it was with quiet, honest sadness.
Given your current circumstances, I will overlook your conduct. This time.
Jarman snorted.
Commodore, whatever you think of me, Ramsay snapped, you will accord Dr. Smith and Miss Noble every professional courtesy. If you don't, I will have you arrested and replaced, sir.
Jarman looked momentarily stunned and then composed himself, a dark glitter in his eyes.
As you wish, sir, he saluted and stalked out of the room.
Donna whistled quietly.
Nice fella. I used to have a boss like him, right, little Hitler?
Ramsay gave her a slightly quizzical look.
Please forgive him. He's had a tough time of late. Lost his wife last year and his son 3 weeks ago.
He turned to the doctor.
All you wish to do is investigate that U-boat.
That's it, the doctor said. Cross my heart.
I'll lay on a boat to take you out there, Ramsay said. The first sign of trouble and my men blasted out of the water.
The sun will be turned to darkness.
The doctor and Donna turned at the sound of the voice behind them. Clayton had his head bowed as he spoke. And the moon turned to blood before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Thank God that I am blind, for I will not see the evil any more.
What do you mean?
Asked the doctor. Clayton's voice was grave. The end of days. It's coming. The doctor exhaled slowly and looked at the floor. Indeed, if the creature from that sphere had escaped and made contact with humans, then the chaplain may well be right. In the cool, damp corridor outside, Jarman seethed with fury. The forgotten man, always overlooked, always overruled. A career playing second fiddle to others, never achieving the heights of what he knew he was capable. He turned and headed for the communications office, an idea forming in his mind. This new arrival, this doctor, was a threat to national security. Why could no one else see it? He had to be removed, his schemes exposed. Then they would have to listen to him. Then he would be taken seriously. Smiling now, he stood in the office doorway, his head cocked to one side. He looked at the rating monitoring the radio. Softly closing the door, he took out his pistol. "Sharpington, isn't it?" he asked quietly. "If you ever mention that I have been here, you will be executed as a spy." Sharpington swallowed nervously, not understanding what was going on. Jarman leaned in close, so close that the rating could feel the breath on his face. "I want you to send a message to the Germans. I want you to send them a set of coordinates." Jarman jabbed his finger at a point on the map on the wall. "These coordinates," he said. Sharpington's eyes widened.
"But that's the location of the war tunnels. I can't send them to the Germans."
Jarman pushed the barrel of the gun into his ribcage.
"You will do as you're ordered, and when called upon to do so, you will say who told you to send this message. And do you know what your answer will be?"
"No, sir."
"You will say that the man who forced you to give away our position was Dr. John Smith."
A blinding flash from the searchlight flared briefly and then moved on, fingering the chill fog. In the bow of the patrol boat, Fosbrook and Mansell were peering into the murk. At the helm, Lieutenant Hobbs was wrapped up tightly against the cold. Behind him stood the doctor and Donna, now nattily attired in smart 40s clothes. The doctor had even brushed his hair to one side, creating a stylish parting. Suddenly a shout from the bows.
"There, sir! Port quarter!"
Lieutenant Hobbs gently eased back on the throttle, and then all at once, the hulking iron-grey conning tower of the U-boat was towering above the little patrol boat. The cylindrical tower rose maybe 6 metres above the body of the submarine, and a ladder rose from sea level to the entrance hatch at the top.
"It's just drifting,"
Hobbs murmured, steering gently alongside and cutting the engines.
"Ahoy there!"
No answer. The doctor beamed a big smile. "You can stand your men down, Lieutenant. I'm only taking Miss Noble. Just the two of us." He flashed a cheeky grin at Donna. "What do you say, Mom?" Donna brushed back her hair.
"Why not, old chap? I'm all AJ squared away in anchor face, so I'll splice the main brace."
The doctor raised an eyebrow and opened his mouth to speak. Donna raised her hand.
"Don't," she said. "You're so predictable. I know exactly what you were going to say, so just don't, all right?"
For once, the doctor was speechless. As Donna walked past him, she grinned and winked. "You coming?" Inside the U-boat, the doctor's torch beam cut through the inky blackness. Donna prodded him in the back.
"Come on, get a move on, Lanky."
"Oh, smell that air," he said. "Diesel, dust and decay." As they stepped through into the next compartment, Donna stumbled and fell heavily against a stack of metal drums. The doctor helped her to her feet.
"Are you all right?"
Donna smiled.
"Yeah,
teach me to wear sensible shoes in future." He pointed his torch at a chemical insignia on the side of the drums.
"Cyclone B," the doctor whistled through his teeth. "Ooh, very nasty. Hydrogen cyanide in solution. They must have been headed for a concentration camp."
"I wonder where everyone's gone," Donna mused. As she yanked open the door to the next compartment,
something leapt at her. She caught a flash of a mouth frozen wide open at a terrible scream and started back, stifling a cry. The thing toppled to the floor at her feet. The doctor knelt down beside it. "It's all right, it's, dead." "That is just gross," she squirmed.
"It's completely dehydrated. Every drop of blood has been drained out," he said bleakly. "I was hoping we'd find that thing before it started its breeding cycle again. I've got a horrible feeling we're already too late."
"Do you think it's still on board?" Donna asked.
The doctor pointed the torch beam deeper into the bowels of the U-boat.
"I'd stay close if I were you."
"Coming," he said cheerily.
I'm sticking by you, matey. Don't you worry about that, Donna said.
In the next compartment, more desiccated bodies were sprawled across the deck, some hidden in the shadows. Donna's torch played over a shape slumped under a control console.
Doctor, she said urgently. That's it, isn't it?
The doctor tentatively approached the crumpled shape and knelt down next to it. Tough,